I would like to let you in on a new project from the Asbury Church Planning Initiative. Coming soon to our website is the new Church Planning Connection job board. This new job board is designed to connect planters with congregations and congregations with planters. Our hope is that as congregations begin to search for planters, they could find them through posting jobs on our website. Look for that feature coming very soon. Greetings, friends. This is episode 9 of season 2, Culture Making, with Drew Stedman, leader of the Antioch Movement. In this episode, Winfield and Drew discuss the primacy of making disciples, formational culture, and the coming renewal in the church. We hope you enjoy their conversation. You are listening to Church Planning Conversations with Dr. Winfield Bevins.
Greetings. We want to welcome everyone out to the Asbury Church Planning Conversations podcast. And we're excited for this week's podcast to have Drew Stedman, who's the U.S. Director for the Antioch Movement. They're involved with planning churches across the U.S., but also they have churches around the world. Drew's got a real heart and passion for disciple-making churches and has really become a good friend over the years. And so I'm excited to have Drew with us today. Drew, how are you doing?
Yeah, thanks, Winfield. It's an honor to get to be on this podcast. And I just appreciate this chance to share with everyone and dive into this topic, church planting.
Why don't you kind of just introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners and tell everyone kind of about what Antioch's doing. I'd love to kind of hear some more about the Antioch movement.
Sure. So I've been serving with Antioch now since 2003, which makes me feel a lot older than I actually am. But I got involved really through discipleship. I was a student at Baylor University, and I came from a Christian background, but it was here at this shot to me and started investing in me and analytic and transformative in my life. And so I didn't really have a career path, but wanted to serve the church and wanted to make disciples. And one thing led to another, and here I am today, involved in church planting. And so we have around 45 churches in the United States, several hundred people on the field internationally, working long-term with church planting as well, and all that being done through the local church. So I just get this incredible privilege of supporting churches, a lot of different types of churches, coast to coast, working with them, coming alongside of them as they seek to engage the mission of God.
Oh, that's good. That's good. So how long has Antioch been around?
Great question. The church, Antioch Waco started in the year 1999. However, prior to that, for about 12 years, there was a discipleship training school that was part of another church here in town that eventually planted our church back in 99. And so that happened for about 12 years. And most of that work, it started with a year-long discipleship school that ended up sending people long-term first into the former Soviet bloc, and as that opened up in the early 90s, and then that gradually expanded into different countries around the world. And eventually we planted a church in the United States.
And, you know, again, I love the vision for connecting discipleship and church planting, because oftentimes, to be honest, in North America, the past several decades, church planting is kind of like plant a church, get a crowd, build a building. What you all are talking about or committed to is disciple making. It's missional discipleship. It's discipleship in community and multiplication. And so I'd love to hear a little bit about your heart for discipleship and how that connects to church planting.
We had this interesting experience at our 20-year mark, where we gathered all of our leaders from around the world and just solicited them. We had this kind of several days or really months of prayer and seeking the Lord, but just asking God, you know, what are you leading us into? What are you affirming in us? And we had this interesting question. We asked all of our key leaders, if we had to reduce all of our ministry activities to one thing, what one thing would we choose? And I remember we were at this hotel, we split up into small groups and we all went off and spent time in discussion and debate. And I'm sitting there thinking like, this is going to be a train wreck. How do you choose between prayer and evangelism and care for the poor and worship? Like, how do you pick one, you know?
Yeah.
But I remember our groups came back together and unanimously each group, such a diversity of giftings and perspectives, we all affirmed that we would pick discipleship. Yeah. Because what we felt like was like that, if you get that right, then all the other stuff falls into place. You know, we make disciples of Jesus, and part of being a disciple of Jesus is that you pray. Disciples of Jesus, care for the poor. It's just who we are. And, you know, we were talking this out, but still this like nagging sense of, you know, are we heretics for suggesting that discipleship should be the main thing? And somebody, I forget who, wisely pointed out, like, wasn't that the main thing of Jesus's ministry as well? You know, if you think of his earthly life and all the options he had available to him, what he chose was really counterintuitive, if we think about it, to pour his life into a group of people and choose this earthly ministry. Obviously, in the long run, can see the fruit of that.
Drew, one of the things that I really appreciate about you, you've written on this, and kind of one of the core values of the Antioch movement is that it's really all about discipleship and connecting missional discipleship and church planting. And so often in North America, as I look over the last decade or so, when people say church planting, that means kind of Western kind of launch large growth models, but really we're talking about making disciples in community. And so right. I'd love to just hear a little bit about your heart and passion around how discipleship and church planting are interconnected.
I've sat through so many church planting trainings, you know, everything from like disciple making movements or rapidly reproducing house churches to strategies with launch large mega church and like probably everything in between. You know, it feels like I've sat through a million of them, as I'm sure many people listening have as well. And I always have this nagging thought in the back of my mind of trying to reconcile the training I'm going through with the ministry model of Jesus. Mm. And I often find there's like this incongruency. And I'm not trying to say all the trainings are bad. I've learned a lot in every training and I incorporate these principles. So it's not trying to be negative, but more trying to point out maybe that we might be missing some elements that Jesus thought was really important that some of our cultural assumptions lead us away from. Yeah. And I look at Jesus's ministry model and I think, all right, here's, you know, if there ever was a great preacher or whatever other qualities, I mean, we're talking about the incarnate Christ, like he had it, you know, and yet with all of that in front of him, what he chose to do in his earthly ministry was to live life with 12 people who didn't turn out to always be like the best, brightest, sharpest leaders. And, you know, we're talking about a backwater province of, you know, this country on the edge of the Roman Empire, pretty far removed from power and all the different types of things that we would look for. Like this was not the fast growing suburb of Jerusalem, you know, like that's not how he chose to do his ministry. And so my experience, both in scripture, my own personal life, what I witnessed with churches around the world is that discipleship, first and foremost, I've started using this language of it's a culture. We're actually creating or manifesting, maybe is a better word of saying this, this alternative culture under the Lordship of Christ in the life of the Spirit. And in culture, there are processes, there are methods, there are things like that that go into culture, but culture is also life to live with people. And there's really no shortcut to that.
Yeah.
And so I think at its best, discipleship is this cultural formation of a group of people that are submitted under the Lordship of Christ, committed to walking with him together in community. And the cool thing about culture is it's once you have it, you almost don't even need to have like all these great bells and whistles. People just come into it. And because culture is so powerful, they feel it, it affects them, it changes them. But the downside of that is there's not shortcuts to it either. So if, you know, we like want to employ some new strategy, there's no assembly line for this. And there are definitely things that can help and there's things that can hurt. But I think this culture of disciple making has to be at the core of any kind of movement. So I've been telling people, I don't think it's something that can be mass produced, a culture of discipleship, but if it's healthy, if there really is a culture of discipleship, in the long run, it will be massively reproduced. And you don't even, a lot of the great movements in history, as best I can tell, they didn't have some kind of growth plan. Like they just had such a vibrant, dynamic culture of disciple making and the power of the Holy Spirit that they almost, at least looking backwards, almost spontaneously reproduced in ways that are harder to even wrap your head around. But I think they got that element right. And we've all seen, you know, the dangers of something that grows quickly without a culture of disciple making. So, you know, one of the scariest things in my mind is somebody who has a really great strategy to gather a crowd without a plan to form people in discipleship. And in the end, that typically leads to all kinds of challenges and problems. So, you know, for us, this is something that we've been very intentional in. Even though I talk about it all the time, I'll be the first to tell you, I see more problems than I think we got to figure it out. Yeah. And so it's a commitment. It's a commitment to say this has to be first. This has to be central. I'm unwilling to compromise on discipleship at the core, but also a recognition that certainly not arrived, but maybe just an awareness of how we need to orient our life in ministry.
That's good. Yeah, I mean, Jesus didn't call us to plant churches. He called us to make disciples. And I love that language of really we're talking about creating a culture. And that's what the power of forming new communities of faith are. Essentially, you're creating these cultures of discipleship and disciple making. And that's definitely one of the things that I've seen as you referenced, kind of looking back at movements. Recent book I did was Marks of a Movement that looks at the early dynamics of early Methodism. And I know we've shared and talked about that. Methodism was one of the great examples of what a disciple making movement looks like.
Absolutely.
And the result there, thousands of churches were planted as all around the world as a result of that commitment to discipleship at the core. So that's good. That's good stuff, man. We should write a book on it.
Let's do it. I'm down.
Oh man, I think one of the great things, one of the great opportunities of doing a podcast like this with leaders from different locations, different experience, is to see or to hear what leaders are seeing on the ground. You're working with churches across the U.S. You're connected to a global movement. What are some of the unique things that you're seeing that's exciting? What are some of the things that's emerging post-pandemic? Well, we're endemic now, you know. There's new things emerging out of the last 2 years that is scary, I think, for a lot of people who maybe you're stuck in old paradigms, conventional models of church planning, old church growth models. But there are some unique things that I think are emerging. In some ways, there's not a textbook for this. There's not a roadmap. There's kind of a new world in front of us. And so I'd love to hear what are a couple of things you're seeing? What are some things that excite you about that you're seeing in church planning right now?
Yeah, I love how you framed that question of what's exciting, because I do think we're going to look back at this time. I've been in several conversations recently. We've talked about how when the world changes, it's never overnight. It's normally over years, if not decades. And from a historical perspective, that's a very short amount of time. But like in real life, you don't wake up the next day. Change is still pretty gradual. And if you think about the amount of societal change that we have experienced, even in the last decade, and for sure, when you throw in the pandemic, this is going to, I would imagine future generations will look back at this day and age and see this as a tremendous time of change. And yet, at the same time, a lot of what we're doing in ministry is still the playbook from 20 years ago. And that both excites me and concerns me, because it excites me because I think God's leading us into fresh expressions. For me, it's on the one hand, I'm always a little ambivalent about something that's too innovative. I think we'll see the same ingredients that we've always seen in history of how God's moved in his church, but maybe a new recipe for a new day is a way of looking at that. Same ingredients, but a new recipe. And what I'm excited about, on the one hand, I think if I had to summarize the last few years, I would see it as the decline of cultural Christianity. And so what we're left with is, on the one hand, there are the negative trends that we're all familiar with of, the rise of the nuns, people who no longer affiliate with the church or things like that. On the positive end, I think what we're also seeing is those that are choosing to follow Jesus, there's a new level of commitment and sacrifice. And so there's a vibrancy I see. And what's exciting to me is I see it across the church. People from, I see it in different ones of the Methodist and Wesleyan traditions and the Anglican or, the charismatic Pentecostal world. Like I could just, Baptistic traditions, like I could just see over and over and over again, these different groups all around the world where, our church traditions are different, but there's this deep commitment, resolve, desire to wholeheartedly follow Jesus. And if anything, over the last few years, we've been tested. And yep. Maybe places, and I'll speak for myself, and people can decide if this resonates. Maybe ways I've gotten a little too cozy with the world. I feel that invented by the Lord, or maybe exposed by the Lord. And an invitation's been offered to say, are we willing to maybe gently be brought back to repentance and say, Jesus, it's all you. It's you, your kingdom, your name. And the cool thing about that is when that's your commitment, you look around and you see other people following God in the same way. And there's this joy of walking together. So I have seen more partnership across the body of Christ with unlikely people than I've seen in all my years of ministry.
Yep.
And I see, you know, I see these emerging signs of renewal in the church, and it's not any one expression. I actually see it popping up all over the place. And so I, when I look at the world right now, I'm sobered, but I'm excited as much as anything, because I deeply feel in my spirit, God's doing something new.
Man, I love that. And I absolutely agree with all of that. It's kind of like COVID accelerated all these shifts and challenges and changes and kind of ripped the Band-Aid off and
right.
kind of forced the church to deal with its own baggage, its own sin. And I think you will see tens of thousands of churches close their doors, but that we're already on decline and plateaued. But in the midst of that, you're going to see nominal Christianity die, but you're going to see a stronger, more vibrant faith emerge. And that's what I'm seeing, just like what you said. I'm seeing collaboration, a kind of what I would call a new ecumenicism.
Yes.
Old ecumenicism is kind of like fake unity, you know, around like
right.
least common denominator. The new ecumenicism is united in truth, mission, spirit, the best of tradition, you know, not compromising, but kind of how do we be comprehensive without compromising? Some just
really
exciting things. Yeah, I agree with that. Well, hey, in the midst of that, the flip side is, what are some of the challenges that you see kind of facing the church that the church really has to wrestle with and grapple with maybe in the next 6 to 12 months or even the next couple of years? You know, what are some unique challenges you think planners are having to face there on the field that you're hearing?
I think there's a few. I'll start with the more conceptual level challenge. Is we, you know, on the one hand, I'm always skeptical when somebody tells me they overdo, like the world is changing. You know, the church has been around a long time in a lot of cultures and weathered a lot of crises that are far worse than anything we've seen. But there is a uniqueness where we live, where I don't know that we're used to this situation of those who are confessionally Christian. You know, there's a social status that increased church involvement used to contribute towards in most environments in the United States. And that still happens in parts of the country. So there are parts of the country where that's certainly the case, where you being a part of a vibrant church might also give you some earthly benefits, you know, and maybe in some careers or cities. As a whole, though, that's increasingly no longer the case, where you're not getting any extra societal points by going to church. And certainly when we look at the urban areas, the coastal areas, places like that, there's at times even a social price to be paid for increased church involvement. And I don't know that our discipleship models are ready for that. I don't know that we're ready for that reality. And even a lot of our church planting models, you know, what do you do? It's one thing to plant a church in a fast-growing suburb where you have parents that grew up in church, got out of church in their young adult years, start raising a family and decide they want to raise their kids in church. And that's part of their culture. And it's very easy to reach them by putting a church next door, you know, things like that, a lot of our playbooks, and that'll still work. I'm not saying that's going to go away entirely, but what do we do with the generation of people who really have no context for church whatsoever? And maybe not even antagonistic, maybe sometimes they are, but even if they aren't, just indifference, us putting a church down the street doesn't really do anything. They're still going to go to brunch on Sunday. So how do we reach those people? And what do we do? How do we make disciples where there's maybe a social stigma that's going to be attached to it? And I'm not talking persecution. I think, you know, we see enough around the world that there needs to be some differentiation there. But I think at the same time, you know, there's not necessarily going to be the same benefits. And a lot of our church planting models, and this is, I hope this is a generous critique. A lot of it has been about how do we remove barriers for people and accommodate as much as we can to get them in the door so they can hear the gospel. You see that from various strands of the seeker sensitive movement. You know, when I was in some of my formative years, there was the emergent movement, and there, you know, there's a lot of different ways this has looked. But the idea being that people are spiritually hungry. If we can remove any kind of obstacle for them, then we can make the church accessible. They'll come through the doors and receive Christ. There probably is some truth to that, but I don't see that as the future. I think,
yeah.
Actually, as I look at it, I think the church needs to embrace our distinction And it's more about potency than it is relevance, is my estimation. We still have to make it accessible for people so they can understand what's going on. And I'm not suggesting that we should try to be weird or over the top or anything like that. But I think it's far more about my neighbor who's used to going to brunch is in a crisis in life. And they walk through the doors of our church, whether that's a house church or some kind of small group or Sunday morning expression. And really, you know, from charismatic to liturgical, like in one way, they walk in the doors and encounter the presence and power of the Holy Spirit in a way that actually meets them in an environment where the, you know, secular culture is unable to. To me, that's what the church needs to be leaning into, where we actually embrace distinction more than relevance, where it's power and potency of our witness, more than it is our ability to remove obstacles to people. And you know, there's always going to be tension we have to hold with this, but I think it's perhaps time for us to lean into embracing our distinction. And so, you know, what challenge that presents for planters is I don't know necessarily how those models work, you know, and I know we've read a lot of the same material, and I look at these great movements in history, whether it's the early Pentecostal revivals, both in the United States and around the world, early Methodism, even going back to the early church. So many of them, they emerged out of these deep prayer movements and radical disciple-making communities of people who, they were very different. They were very distinct. And the trend we see is over time, we start to cozy up a little bit against middle-class values and lose the potency of our witness. And so if I had to guess, I think that's what the future of the church in the United States is going to need to be, is very prayerful and committed and distinct. And then from that place, we have a vibrant witness that allows us to speak back in a way that culture is not used to. And I say all of this with a smile on my face and a happy attitude. I don't mean any of it to be combative. I think it's more of us embracing our identity with confidence and then with joy, knowing that we have a place to speak back into the world.
Yeah, I think that's excellent. I think one of the things, and I know we've talked about this, and I've written in a lot of my work, is looking at, say, young adults that are looking back to tradition and liturgy and orthodoxy and, you know, creeds and actually clear statements of the Christian faith. And one of the things we're seeing among some populations is, watering down Christianity, make it super, you know, seeker sensitive and, you know, culturally relevant. Actually, people are looking for, you know, the old time religion. You know, they're looking for, give me Jesus, you know, just give me the cross. They're actually wanting it. And I do think I think that needs to be a part of our training, is how do we equip planners to be able to cross cultures with, you know, core, you know, preaching and proclaiming Jesus. You know, it's almost like we need new models of even just teaching people how to share their faith in fresh new ways for today. And so any thoughts about that, what I just said?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think on a broad conceptual level, something that's helped me, and I'll go a bit philosophical to pull it down to street level, is, I look at secularism as a distinct religion or belief system. And I don't say that as like my enemy. It's not me versus them. It's just more of recognizing it's a belief system that's really pervasive and powerful in our culture. And when I look at it that way, it's actually pretty new. Like it's, you know, last couple hundred years, and it in some ways you could see it as a sect that emerged out of Christianity. And that's a lot of been my work, both with podcasting and writing, is kind of exploring that, of seeing this, that there's really no neutral culture, you know, but there's a Christian belief system and there's a secular belief system and there's others. And then, you know, the world is complicated. So there's a lot of overlap, and that's what makes things tough for us. But the challenge of that, I think, for a lot of Christians, what I see is both looking backwards, like, where are we tethered? What's our history? What's our family tree? You know, is this just something we made up like 50 years ago? And if we can recognize that we're actually tied to something that's thousands of years old and has been expressed all around the world in a variety of times and cultures and eras, who faced unbelievable challenges and often out of the most marginalized sectors of society, you know, just like thing after thing after thing, if we can tap back into that, we see a richness of who God is and how the Spirit has worked in history that then gives us so much for what does it mean to be faithful in our time today. And so I definitely see that same trend of, how do we tap into that and not just look at how do I get a few more people through the door, but a doubling down on our identity first. And then as we have the clarity of our own identity, then we use that as our place for witness. So I certainly see that. And then I think it's also, equipping planters of what does it mean for us to be able to express that to people and not just try to cover over places we're different, but actually with love and with joy, be clear, these are maybe some different assumptions that we have about the world. And we're going to back that up because we're going to pray for you. We're going to expect that God shows up and we're going to be unequivocal about what we feel like the Lord is leading us into as far as a lifestyle of a Christian. Things like that actually present that clarity for people, both in history and in our witness in the world today. So I think that the thing for us all to figure out is what does that actually mean? And when I think of it for a church planter, I'll say if I was planting a church today, I would probably spend a lot more time in prayer than maybe I would have a few years ago. I would spend a lot more time focused on a disciple-making culture at the beginning and really taking that, not just rushing through that so that I get volunteers for our launch Sunday and not putting all my energy into a big Instagram ad buy, so I can get a bunch of people through the door. And I'm not trying to say that all that's wrong. There's a place for that. But what I wouldn't do is minimize the power of really creating a core group of disciples and taking time to ensure that as best we can, we're expressing this commitment to following Jesus very closely together. And then even coming up with shared language about what does that mean and how do we speak back into the world around us. And then there's a lot of it, if anything I've learned the last few years, it's the limitations of my own control and power. And there is this, I think God's leading the church into a reliance that, Lord, if you're not moving, we don't have much to offer. And that's actually a great place to be, as uncomfortable as it is. It's not just me turning up a dial of a little bit more marketing, but it's actually me saying, Holy Spirit, come breathe on your church. And whatever that looks like, whatever your tradition is, relying on God to do the work. And as best I can tell, that's always a catalyst for these great moves of God in history.
Good. I think that kind of intersects with kind of what you said earlier around, discipleship is kind of creating an ethos and a culture. And I think that is what is missing. The book of Judges said there arose a generation that knew not the Lord. And what's happened in North America, because we kind of rejected the great tradition of the church, we've not been able to pass our faith on to the next generation effectively. And we're seeing the fruit of that, if that makes sense. And, James K. Smith's work, a number of his works, You Are What You Love in particular, he talks about cultural liturgies, that kind of like what you're kind of implying is the culture shaping us with a worldview in ways that we don't even realize, but there are habits that are forming and are shaped by that worldview. And so if Christianity is just a belief system disconnected from disciple-making habits, if you will, then it's not going to, what we do forms us, the practices that we practice day in and day out. And that's where we can look to the treasure chest of church history. We can look to disciple-making movements and see how did the Wesleys re-evangelize England? How did Christianity spread across North America or global context? How did Christianity spread in, through the East African revival or house church movements in China? And we can see that there are these cultures, if you will, that the church creates. And that's really the battleground, isn't it? Where our faith.
Absolutely.
Church planning has to be in the intersection between, the gospel and culture. And that's really where God's calling us, is to kind of be in that liminal space.
No, absolutely. And I've actually just got into some of that, this concept of habitus. Yep. And it's this cultural formation that occurs where I love how some writers have talked about it. It's reflexive. So it's not just the things, and this maybe is a limitation of worldview training, is it's very cognitive. And so it's how I think, and that matters. But there's also this other side of things, what I don't think, but I just naturally do. So it shapes everything about me, like my immediate reflexes of how I feel about something, my taste in something. Like a lot of these things are actually products of our own cultural formation. And typically the cultural power that's most formative are the ones you don't even notice. this. And that's, you referenced James K. Smith's work, or we could look at a number of others where it's not so much the class I went to that taught me how to think, but it's actually the world I live in. It's just the water in which I swim is shaping me, shaping my desire, shaping the way that I understand, you know, what is a good life or what does a relationship look like? Like all of these things are what is formed within us in a cultural environment. And I think that's been a big weakness, even in a lot of discipleship training I've been in. You know, I've been in some really good ones that emphasize process over content is this this phrase I've heard many times. And I really appreciate that, where they're saying it's not just cramming facts in people, but it's teaching a process. I would maybe up the ante a little bit and say, I think culture is over process. And it's just completely nonlinear. And this is the challenge to this, is there's no way out of this other than to live it. And I think that's where it gets us a little bit. Like, I can't just delegate this to a volunteer. You know, I can't have a discipleship class and assume that that's going to solve the problem. I actually have to live this. I have to have people in my life. And Andy Crouch wrote this book years ago called Culture Making. And he's talking a lot, his emphasis is a bit more on cultural artifacts like art or things like this. But he has this line that's just haunted me. You know, he talks about how we can critique culture all we want, but if you actually want to change culture, the only way to do it is to create more of it. And I've just stuck with that, where at the end of the day, like, I can get mad at whatever I see, whether that's culture in the church, whether that's poor formation of Christians, whether that's compromise with the world, whether that's things going on in secular culture. Like, I can get mad and critique, and there is a place for cultural critique. Yep. But ultimately, if we want to see change, it's actually creating something new. And yep, that's what I see in the life of Jesus. Like, that's what he did. You know, he created something the world had never seen before. And that's when we look at these movements, you know, and I go back to, like, been studying lately with Dr. Kevin Watson, and he talks a lot about this kind of early Methodist disciple making. And looking at that, and I don't even know that they fully knew what they were doing, you know, but what they had is such a rich, dynamic culture. And that culture was so powerful, so formative, that people walk in and they don't even know what's happening to them, but they're being changed. It's the habitus, it's the reflexes of that culture. And so I've experienced this. I remember years ago, I had this, we have a life group, at the time, I don't know, maybe 10 families, and we would do this smaller guys discipleship group that would meet weekly. And a guy was new, he showed up, and we're just doing some, what I felt like was really basic accountability. And at the end, his jaw just dropped. And he's like, I have never been in a group that talked like this. And I didn't even have a master plan. It's just like, this is just what we do. And I forgot how different what we did was from what other people did. And now this friend of mine is like, he's, you know, one of the most vulnerable, best guys I know when it comes to holding other men accountable. But there was never a class he went to on this. There wasn't a checklist. It was just a culture of vulnerability that was formed. And then as other people showed up, it was formed in them. And, you know, and it's just a product of a vibrant culture. And so, you know, on the one side, what's really awesome about that is you can start today, get a few people, and you look at all these movements, they all started small. And I think when they all started, I don't know that they could have foreseen what would have occurred years later. They all started small, but they were very vibrant and rich and real, and they actually created something new because of the commitment of their lives. And so that's both the opportunity and the challenge facing planters, because it's inconvenient and it's not going to be something you want to do all the time. And, you know, it's a lot easier. Like, I'll just be vulnerable. For me, it's so much easier for me to go lock myself in a room and prepare a sermon or gather a team together and plan out, you know, some really powerful event. Like, that's not hard. But then it's like, okay, actually, I got to go live life with people and get in their world. And, you know, when I'm tired and still be vulnerable when I don't want to, or I have to share the stuff that's going on inside of me that I'd rather not, you know, like all that kind of stuff, right? That's what's hard. But I'm so convinced that if we'll commit to that there's, you know, I just see it over and over again. Like, that's, God shows up when his people really embrace the ways of the kingdom.
You got to live it. You got to live it. That's what I'm hearing. And again, so reminded, you know, early Methodism was called early Methodism because they had a method. they had a
amen.
And and what I love about disciple making is it starts small. It always starts small. And, you know, one of my favorite books that really impacted me early on, and gosh, I don't know how long it's been around, but Robert Coleman's master plan of evangelism.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Is that it just basically, how did Jesus make disciples? He chose 12 men and he poured into a small group of people. It wasn't the multitude, it was the few. I call it the law of the few. And when we first got into planting, that was essentially it. It was pouring into a few key leaders over the course of a couple of years, raising them up. And then that's when multiplication happens. And that's when culture is created, is in the small, Malcolm Gladwell's tipping point. You know, he looks at kind of how ideas become epidemics, so to speak. And it always, movements, viruses, it always starts with, you know, kind of the smaller kind of two or three, and then it begins to multiply from there. And that's how we create culture. You know, we don't have to, you know, you can dream big, but you always have to start small.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you hit this point, but just to pull it out a bit more, is culture is always going to be partnered with some kind of, you know, method, or you say cultural liturgies, or, you know, whatever the case may be. And I've really enjoyed looking at different church groups, and, you know, almost every major church movement started in a revival somewhere. And you can still see these traces of what were these habits that they found so helpful regarding formation. And I think that has to be paired. You know, there's both on the one hot side, this like very authentic, real culture of disciple making, but then on the other, there are the habits of that community, and those, you know, nourish the discipleship culture, and it becomes this really cool relationship when it's done right. And in a way, there's so much pressure right now to back off of that. You know, it's like, oh, we have extracurricular, people are tired. We have, you know, we don't want to be accused of being legalistic. We don't, whatever the case may be. And there's this temptation to water all that down. And I think we have to resist that impulse and say, actually, if we're going to have formative power in our cultures, we probably need to up the ante a little bit. Yeah. And are we actually calling people to a high standard? Are we actually willing to meet? Are we actually committed to the things of the kingdom and being okay with it? You know, in different church traditions, if, you know, maybe that's a commitment to pray the daily office. Maybe that's, you know, a standard time with God in the morning. Maybe that's something else. Like at one point, like I'm not so uptight about what that actually looks like as much as, are we actually calling people to things? Are we being faithful? And I've become more of a believer than ever on consistent weekly worship and consistent engagement in some kind of small group community. And in my mind, it's not like any one of those is a silver bullet. I just think you have to add them all up together if we want to be a part of churches that have formative power. Because like reality is, just doing one of them, or lowest, you said earlier, lowest common denominator Christianity, will not form us. Like I spend all day embracing the cultural liturgies of the world around me. Like how on earth do I think that a 30-minute sermon is somehow going to offset whatever hours and hours I'm receiving of input from social media? Like it's just not going to work. We have to have a vibrant community that actually forms people. And that takes time, that takes habits, and that takes intentionality.
I love that. Drew, man, we could go on, dude. I could talk to you forever about this stuff. I would love for you to just share real quickly how people can find out more about the work that you're doing. We've got planters literally around the world and all across the U.S. that listen to the podcast. How can people find out more about the work you're doing with Antioch, or maybe even your own personal website or social media?
That's great. Yeah, I have a podcast I host called Ideology, and a friend of mine and I, he actually leads the discipleship school here for Antioch. And so we co-host the podcast together. We talk a lot about cultural formation and discipleship and some of these topics. So we'd love to have people check that out. And especially, where does that intersect with modern cultural trends that we see around us, and how do we make sense of that? So that's a good starting point. If someone is interested with Antioch, there's a book written by our founder called Passion and Purpose that just tells the story of how God has moved in a lot of our work around the world and in the United States. And hopefully that will encourage anyone who, especially if you're interested in church planting and engagement in the community, we'd love to have people check that out as well. And then I've written two books. One is called The Gospel According to Culture, and it's looking at how do we take cultural Christianity, the various gospel messages we find in secularism, and how do we put that in conversation with the gospel as given to us by Jesus? And then a second book is called Go Make Disciples, which is a lot more practical, and it's probably specifically designed for congregations to, what does it look like to build out a discipleship culture within a church. And so, yeah, any of those resources, you can find the books, all three of those, on Amazon, and would love to have people check that out. And then podcast, Spotify, Apple, or, you know, wherever else you do your podcast, I'm sure we're there.
Awesome.
Drew, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it's an honor to be on here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Church Planning Conversations podcast, a production of Asbury Theological Seminary. Don't miss our season finale on episode 10 coming soon.